This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne, in for Matthew Petty. Today marks 50 years since Apollo 11 launched from Kennedy Space Center, sending Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins on a mission that would land the first humans on the moon. Hundreds of thousands of people worked on the Apollo program to make this mission happen and win the space race. But the race to the moon started years before, as NASA learned the basics of launching humans into space. To talk more about the missions that got NASA to the moon and how Apollo shaped the space program, we're joined by UCF historian Amy Foster. Amy, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's go back even farther than 50 years, and let's talk about the early human space program at NASA, Mercury and Gemini. How did this get jump-started, what were some of the early goals of human spaceflight?
Well, certainly with the Mercury program, it was just about getting a man into space and bringing him safely back. So kind of that, the abbreviated version of what Kennedy is going to announce, put him up, bring him back, alive, ideally, right? So, you know, the Mercury program begins in May of 1961, officially with the launch of Alan Shepard. Those astronauts were selected in 1959. 1958 is when NASA is formed, when Eisenhower signs the National Air and Space Act, which also shortened to NASA. But it creates NASA. It basically consumes the NACA, the National Advisory Council for Aeronautics, which had been in existence since the 19-teens, and becomes NASA. So it's now the National Air and Space Administration. So there's still a lot of aviation stuff going on. But what Eisenhower wanted was something that was scientifically motivated. It wasn't meant to be political. And so when we see the Mercury program start, it really is just about let's learn about space, let's put humans up and see what the next step is. He purposely wanted to make sure it wasn't political. Now, he had some political machinations going on underneath. We knew the Soviets were close to putting humans into space. They had already launched Sputnik when Eisenhower, signs the National Air and Space Act. There was a lot of tension in the United States to beat the Soviets. So when we put our first man up in space, Eisenhower is now out of office. Kennedy is in office. Space is kind of that open ground for possibilities. So after Alan Shepard flies, and it was a suborbital flight. It went up, it came back down. Yep, a parabolic flight, 15 minutes. It's after that flight that Kennedy makes the announcement that we're going to go to the moon. And when I teach space history, I kind of call it like the most boneheaded decision he could have made, because we only had that 15 minutes of experience. When the Mercury program comes to an end, and that program was really just about proving the technology, proving that we could do the basics. So Gordon Cooper is the last man to fly in the Mercury program in 1963. And basically, the majority of the systems in his capsule were dead. Clock was still working, life support was still working, not a whole lot else. And that's because after 25 hours of flight, the batteries were almost completely consumed. And it takes 3 days just to get to the moon. So, when I'm teaching space history, I point out the fact that from 1963 to, no less than 1970, battery technology alone has to come so far. And battery technology is still something that we struggle with. Everyone's cell phone seems to die very quickly. It's still the biggest challenge they think that hybrid cars are dealing with, is like the longevity of those batteries. Well, there's no real opportunity to plug back in for those batteries in space. So just getting batteries that are going to last 7 hours or 7 days, is a big challenge from just a small technical aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a long way to go from Mercury to successful Apollo mm-hmm. in 1969.
What was the mood like in NASA or at NASA after that speech? Was that a speech that fired up leaders in NASA, or was it a speech that they were like, oh man, we're not going to be able to do this?
It's the, oh man, we're not going to be able to do this. So Kennedy did sit down with James Webb, who was the NASA administrator, before he made that announcement. He sat down with Webb, and he sat down with Lyndon Johnson, who was his vice president and a big supporter of the space program. And that's actually something that we tend to mislabel Kennedy as somebody who was a fan of the space program. He wasn't. He, you know, his agenda was civil rights, but things had been going wrong for Kennedy in the early part of his presidency. The Bay of Pigs fiasco had happened just before he makes that announcement. He needs a political win. And so he sits down with Johnson and he sits down with Webb and says, all right, so far we've been losing this whole space game. We're second in multiple things, putting a satellite up, putting a living creature up, putting a man up. What can we do to beat the Soviets? And, you know, Webb certainly knew the program well, and he knew where NASA was at. And he said, if anything, we can beat them to the moon. That's like the closest, best thing we've got. They're probably going to put two men up before us. They're going to put some version of a space station up before us. All we basically have is the moon.
So they're looking as far off as it's not a moonshot, it's a long shot at this point.
It's a long shot, but that was the best long shot he could give Kennedy. So when Kennedy made that speech in front of Congress that says we're going to put a man safely on the moon and bring him back, Webb knew he was going to make that announcement. But his reaction was, who wants my job? Seriously, who wants my job? Because he knew just how much still had to happen. It is a long shot. It's the best long shot I can offer you, Mr. President, but it's still a long shot. And so it was tense. It was definitely tense. And, you know, when we look at the amount of work that goes into what NASA was doing from that announcement to the successful landing in July of 1969, we have hundreds of thousands of man hours working on that project. And I will say to people when they say, it wasn't really the moon landing, just filmed in a soundstage in Arizona or whatever. I'm like, okay. So we're now approaching the 50th anniversary. We've had hundreds of thousands of people working on this project, and not a single one has come out in 50 years and sold that story for more money than he knows what to do with. You can't keep people quiet that long. Yeah. You know, so this was an extraordinarily intensive project for NASA.
So we go from the first Mercury mission of this parabolic flight, just up and down, 15 minutes, suborbital, and now there's this goal of putting humans on the moon, which is 250,000 miles away.
Right.
What happens in between? And you have 5 minutes to tell me. No, I'm kidding. What happens in between? What are the next steps going from Mercury to Gemini to Apollo?
So Gemini was fairly laid out at that point. So there's a second suborbital flight. Gus Grissom flies a second suborbital flight. And that's with a Redstone rocket. It's just not powerful enough to really get a capsule into orbit. So what NASA is doing during those first two Gemini flights is actually getting the Atlas rocket ready. Which is what John Glenn is going to ride when he goes into orbit for the first time. So it's really still just progressing that technology, even through Mercury. We're expanding the life of the batteries. We're expanding the life of the general technology, and we're expanding the life of those rockets. Almost immediately, NASA's working on Apollo. They have to. There's just not enough time. But there's still some things that NASA has to be able to do to land on the moon. That includes long-duration flight. That includes rendezvous, the ability to walk and work in space.
This is docking with another spaceship in orbit.
Rendezvous, yes. So meeting up with and then successfully docking and undocking and all that. Yeah. So those are skills that NASA needs to be able to do to successfully land on the moon, but they can't test all those steps with the big rocket that they're planning to use to go to the moon, because the Saturn V rocket is still in development. Saturn I, Saturn V, those are all part of the Apollo program. So they start Gemini. So Gemini is the program where they're putting two men up in a capsule, and it really is a stopgap program. It's the program that NASA uses to prove that they have mastered those general skills that they need for Apollo to be successful. So with Gemini 7, Frank Borman and Jim Lovell are going to fly in space for 14 days. So that covers that 8-day flight that essentially is going to get Apollo to the moon and back. When you talk to those two, or when they tell stories about that flight, they say, we sang every song we knew to each other. We told every story that we knew to each other. They just, because mostly you're in this in a capsule the size.
You're sitting on the couch,
yeah. Yeah, you're in the size of something, the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. And so there's not a lot of room to float around. So it's basically sit and chat and yeah, just kill time. But what they were doing is proving you could survive that length of time. So that was an important skill, even if it seems fairly simple. You know, can somebody live in space for that long in a microgravity environment and then still be able to function? Those are really important things. We can't send a person there and bring him safely back if he's not going to survive the return trip because he's out of conditioning. So those were really important steps. So Gemini is all about proving those capabilities. And it's often kind of the forgotten program because it doesn't have any of those splashy things. It has some firsts. It has some really important firsts. Spacewalking. Mm-hmm. We first do that during Gemini, but they're not the first men and they don't land on the moon. So it's kind of that underwhelming, sadly forgotten program, but it was an extraordinarily important program. I mean, this is several years of continual practice. Mm-hmm. To make that happen.
But it's happening in such a short period of time. It's this less than 10 years of development to go from the suborbital flight to steps on the moon.
It really is extraordinary. I think when we, as historians, when we try to look back and say, what is the historical legacy of Apollo, it really is, it says a lot about the human spirit. It says a lot about gumption. It says a lot about what goal setting can do to mobilize not only just a workforce, but a nation.
Now, looking back 50 years, Apollo 11 launches from what is now the Kennedy Space Center. Mm-hmm. After, you know, these 9 years of rapid development happen. Let's take even a farther step back. Mm-hmm. Why was it Florida that was selected? Why did Florida get to be the threshold to putting humans on the moon?
So there's a fair amount of advantages to actually launching from a lower latitude. You know, we have lots of places in the United States. We cover a lot of geography in the United States. But given the way the Earth spins and just the speed of the rotation, there really is an advantage from launching from one of those lower latitudes. Certainly, Lyndon Johnson would have loved the launch port to be in Texas because that's his home state. But ultimately, Florida is the one that wins out. And it has a lot to do with the fact that we're located right next to the Atlantic Ocean. So one of the big challenges that we see with launch is launch failure. And when something goes wrong, it goes wrong spectacularly, as we saw with Challenger. And launching from a place, you know, we're always launching to the east. The only other time you would see anything launch is if you're trying to put something in polar orbit, and then you launch directly north. And that is, in fact, why we do still launch polar orbit satellites out in California, because the Earth is going to spin underneath. You launch, and the land moves to the east, and the rocket is still going north, so it's over then the Pacific Ocean. But as we're launching to the east, anything that may go wrong will land in the ocean. And from the geographical standpoint, as well as from a power standpoint, you don't need to use as much fuel if you can kind of get a little push from the rotation of the Earth. Makes a lot of sense to do it from mm-hmm. Florida.
Now, with Kennedy's charge, there has to be this massive infrastructure that's built at the Kennedy Space Center to support the Apollo missions. Kind of tell me a bit about how the Apollo program shaped what we now see as the Kennedy Space Center.
I'm not sure the Kennedy Space Center would be there if it weren't for the Apollo program. So we often think of, you know, Kennedy Space Center as being where everything launched. No. Most of our early rockets were actually being launched from the air station out there, for the Canaveral Air Station. All of Mercury, all of Gemini launched at the Canaveral Air Station. So this is an Air Force operation, ultimately. We're using their facilities. So it's really in the early 60s, after Kennedy makes his announcement, really at the end of Mercury, that KSC is really, it's commissioned and the work starts. So when we think about what launched from Kennedy Space Center, it's really only the early Apollo missions that finally are the first things to launch. I believe it's 1968 before anything actually launches from Kennedy Space Center property. If it weren't for this massive buildup, I think we could make the argument that Kennedy Space Center may not be there. We would have simply just continued to use what Canaveral Air Station was able to offer in terms of support.
Tell me a little bit, we spoke about this earlier, about how risky those early Gemini flights were. And there was a lot of risk in Apollo, and Apollo 1 especially, when there was the loss of three crew members.
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about the known risk to this program and, you know, how did that kind of steer the direction of Apollo?
You know, for that first flight to have, and it wasn't even a flight, it was, you know, they were testing on the pad, for that to end in the loss of human life, certainly changed the mood within NASA entirely, but it certainly affected the people who worked out of KSC, because they worked so closely with those astronauts. Probably the only other place that felt it as deeply would be Johnson Space Center, where the astronauts trained. So these people know these men intimately. The launch crew, of course, were the ones who strapped them into that capsule and then couldn't get them out. So it's that is always going to hit really hard. So the impact, I think, of that accident reminded everyone that this still is an extraordinarily dangerous business. Not that anybody really doubted that, but it when things do go right, you know, there is a tendency for complacency or even just a little bit of self-pride. And nature has a way of banging that out of us pretty often. You know, so the risk involved, I think, were very well known. Chris Kraft, who was one of the flight directors during the Apollo program, said that if that accident hadn't happened, we might not have gotten to the moon by the end of the decade. Because everything was happening so quickly in terms of development, you know, small changes were being made, weren't necessarily always making it back to the engineers who had done the design. It was the number of memos on changes that were made would probably stack several, you know, feet off the floor if we put them all together in a pile. And keeping track of all of those over several years of development becomes not only daunting, but impossible to keep track of. So what that accident did, though, and this is what Chris Kraft acknowledged, was because it happened on the ground, the engineers were able to take that capsule apart piece by piece, not only to figure out what went wrong, but how to make it right. But, you know, that accident happened in January of 1968, and we don't even try a flight again until at least not a human flight until much later that year. We have the first orbit around the moon in December of 1968. And that's actually a really fantastic flight. It's the first flight where humans take a picture of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. This is Apollo 8.
Apollo 8. It's known as Earthrise. And it is one of those iconic pictures that is very closely associated with the rise of the environmental movement. When we see our planet Earth, our Earth, as our home planet, it does inspire a lot of, I think, hopeful feelings.
Mm-hmm.
After a very difficult year mm-hmm. for the United States.
That is a lot of what the Apollo program's legacy is, right, is inspiration. You have this Apollo effect, which inspires, you know, scientists and engineers to get into the field. You know, kids that watched Neil and Buzz walk on the moon want to be the people that are helping the next set of people get there. As a historian looking back, what would you say the Apollo program's legacy was?
From a motivational standpoint, like I've said, I think when you put a challenge like that, an unimaginable challenge, I mean, there are certainly people in that time period that said, walking on the moon, that's an impossibility. You know, and of course, there are still people today who say it didn't happen because it still seems like such an impossibility. We look up in the sky and we see the moon and we know it's that far away. And we can't imagine getting there. It's still pretty extraordinary to think about the fact that after thousands of years, tens of thousands of years of human existence, finally in 1969, we step foot on another body. And that's it's still extraordinarily mind-blowing and humbling to find yourself in a world where we can say, yes, we have walked on the moon.
We've been speaking with Amy Foster. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Central Florida. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This hour, 50 years ago, Apollo 11 launched from the Kennedy Space Center. Those small steps on the moon started with one giant launch of the Saturn V rocket from Kennedy Space Center's Launch Complex 39A. Here's what that sounded like on the morning of July 16th, 1969.
8.9 seconds. We're approaching the 60-second mark on the Apollo 11 mission. T-minus 60 seconds and counting. We passed T-minus 60. 55 seconds and counting. Neil Armstrong just reported back. It's been a real smooth countdown. We passed the 50-second mark. Power transfer is complete. We're on internal power with the launch vehicle at this time. 40 seconds away from the Apollo 11 liftoff. All the second stage tanks now pressurized. 35 seconds and counting. We are still go with Apollo 11. 30 seconds and counting. Astronauts report it feels good. T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Neil Armstrong reporting their roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on proper heading. Plus 30 seconds.
They were off on a quarter of a million mile trip to the moon. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne, in for Matthew Petty. We're looking back at the Apollo 11 mission, 50 years on. When Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon, millions tuned in live to watch the event. The moon landing inspired many to pursue an education and career in aerospace in what is now called the Apollo Effect. Phil Metzger was one of those kids who grew up around the Apollo program on Florida's Space Coast and went on to study engineering and eventually work at NASA. As a young man, he was nudged by his dad, Theodore Metzger, who worked on the Apollo program. Now, Metzger works at UCF's Florida Space Institute as a planetary scientist. From the education desk this week, Metzger joins us now to talk about growing up in the era of Apollo. Phil, thanks for speaking with us.
Hello, Brendan. I'm glad to be back.
Well, let's start with your inspiration, because you are not the first generation to be involved in space exploration. Let's talk about your dad. What did he do?
Yeah, well, my dad worked during the Apollo program. He was in the Air Force, and when he retired from the Air Force, he got a job working out at the Kennedy Space Center. So he came back to his hometown to work on space.
And so tell me about growing up with a dad working in the Apollo program. That had to have been really cool as a young boy, right?
Yeah, it was. I grew up assuming that this is what you do when you're an adult. You work on space programs. So I remember I built paper models of satellites, and I remember going out to the open house at the Kennedy Space Center whenever they had a family day. I grew up in a bedroom community of the space program, so a lot of my neighbors' parents worked on the space program as well.
What did your dad do for NASA?
Well, he was a ground systems technician, and he actually wasn't technically a technician. He was in logistics, so he was a flight engineer in the Air Force, and then he worked on the logistics of the rocket parts and also the ground system parts. He would work in the offices of in the VAB. Or out on the launch pad, various locations, keeping the cranes working, the fueling systems. And, you know, he wanted me to be an engineer because he saw the engineers out there working, and his dream was that one day I would grow up and be an engineer. So he pushed me in that direction. When I was in college, I tried to go in other directions, but he kept saying, no, you need to be an engineer. And so I eventually listened to him and became an engineer. And I worked as an engineer out there for about 15 years before I went back to grad school and became a planetary scientist.
Mm-hmm. What was your dad's name?
Theodore Metzger.
Where were you when Apollo 11 launched from the Kennedy Space Center?
I was behind the United States Post Office, which was on the shore of the Indian River in Titusville. I was 7 years old, I think. So there was an awning behind the post office where the mail trucks could drive under when it rained. And so I climbed up one of the poles of that awning so I could see over the adults to watch the launch.
And take us back to that moment. What was it like seeing such a historical mission launch, knowing that your dad had an integral part in it?
Well, like I said, I think we lacked perspective. We didn't realize how amazing it was. When I became an adult, that was when I really grasped the significance that humanity is stepping on another world for the first time. As a child, of course, it was exciting because of the great crowds of people coming into town with their campers, and the city was choked with visitors from all across the United States. So that was exciting. We would take our lawn chairs down to the shore on all of the Apollo launches. And then the launch was beautiful. You'd see the flames, you'd see the smoke, you'd see the light as the rocket started to get up a little bit above the ground. You'd see that trail of flame. And my favorite part was when it was high in the sky and it staged. The first stage would fall away and the second stage would ignite. And at that high altitude, it would flare way out, this great umbrella of rocket exhaust plume. It was beautiful.
Now, some years later, after the Apollo programs, you go to school, you study engineering. What was your first job out of school?
I worked for NASA.
All right.
So my first job right out of school was working on the communication and navigation systems on the space shuttle. At that time, a lot of the Apollo veterans were still there. My boss was an Apollo veteran. And there were paraphernalia from the Apollo days on their office walls and on their cubicle walls. So it was like moving right into that environment.
Mm-hmm. What about your dad? How proud was Theodore to know that you were working for NASA right out of college?
Yeah, he was very proud. I think my whole family was.
Do you remember your first shuttle launch that you worked on?
Of course. Yeah, it was terrifying to me because before I worked for NASA, I just thought NASA was this world where perfection exists and it's so perfect that there's nothing to worry about. And then I got there and I realized that these are real people working on very complex hardware, much more complex than I had imagined. And I was terrified to realize how complicated this really is. I don't think the public still has any idea about it. And so I was terrified. And every launch, I was terrified. And then we lost one. We lost the 10th launch that I was there. And so it was a really bad several years as we recovered, as we figured out how it happened, how did we make this mistake, and how do we keep it from happening again. But then, as you know, we had another loss. We lost Columbia in a very different kind of accident. And what I want to say is that trying to manage a program where you're operating the most complex thing humanity has ever built is—it's never going to be free of risk. There's always going to be those. Well, as long as we're humans, you know, maybe when we create better artificial intelligence, we can make rocket launching perfect. But it's the nature of rocket launching. It's an overused phrase, but space is hard. So that was what I saw when I first hired there. I realized, wow, space really is hard.
In the days of Apollo, we had this, you know, incredible triumph of not only the NASA American space program, but humanity by putting humans on the moon, which inspired people to get into science and engineering to do just that. You were inspired by your dad who was working on that. And with the absence of something like that, has that put this country at a disadvantage in the sense that we don't have the people that are as inspired to get into the space or aerospace field? Are we looking at a shortfall in talent to help with this Artemis mission.
I think you're right that the space program is tremendously inspirational, and we need a program, we need a destination like the Artemis destination in order to maximize the benefit of the space program. I have a friend who travels the world doing developmental work in war zones, and he'll go into a war zone and set up a space day, and he'll ask people like myself to Skype into these children and talk to them about space. And he tells me nothing is like space to help people lift their eyes above the hardships of life here on the Earth, because space is expansive, it doesn't have measurable boundaries, and it paints a picture of the future that could be, the future that we want to create. When we show people that we're moving into space, it gives them a door, a front door that they can go through to participate in creating that better future.
Thinking over the past 50 years, are you optimistic in the direction of where we are going when it comes to space exploration?
Yeah, so I am very optimistic. I think we've had a lot of excellent developments over the past 10 or 20 years. We see commercial space starting to take off like it never has before. We see private investors creating companies, billionaires creating companies. And we see a lot of innovation coming out of that sector.
What about your dad? Would he be optimistic for the future?
I think he would be. I think he'd be very excited. I think he would be very proud to see that I'm still working in space and celebrating what he did 50 years ago.
We've been speaking with Phil Metzger. He is a planetary scientist at the Florida Space Institute at the University of Central Florida. He spent 30 years with NASA, and his father, Theodore Metzger, worked on the Apollo program at the Kennedy Space Center. Phil Metzger, thanks so much for speaking with us.
That was my pleasure, Brendan.
Still to come, growing up as an astronaut's son. Andy Aldrin, son of Buzz Aldrin, takes us back to the 1960s to reflect on what it was like to have a moonwalking dad. Intersections back in a minute.
Came into this world, I was lost, not found. Did not hold me in its arms like it holds me now. So I dreamt myself a bird who could cross the waves. And I woke up just a man who was miles away. Miles away. Miles away. And I stayed up there for a year or two.
Famous picture of me. This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne, in for Matthew Petty. Andy Aldrin was 11 years old when his dad, Buzz, walked on the moon. Aldrin grew up in Nassau Bay, Texas, where many astronaut families lived as they trained for the moon missions. Despite having a dad that was about to embark on a half-million-mile business trip, life was pretty ordinary. I recently sat down with Andy Aldrin to reflect on his time growing up the son of a moonwalker. So, Andy, when was the moment that you knew that your dad did something that was a little extraordinary?
You know, to be absolutely honest with you, it probably wasn't until 1972, to be really honest, because for most of the time we were in Texas, it was kind of normal. And it wasn't until we moved to California that I realized that maybe it was a big deal.
What was it like growing up with a father who was a NASA astronaut, you know, this elite group of men, and you're there for the ride as a kid?
Right. It was normal, right? Because you couldn't swing a dead cat at our elementary school without hitting an astronaut's kid. And so we lived, just as an example, we lived at the end of a cul-de-sac, so we had one of these pie-shaped lots, and there were five houses on the back. Three of them were astronauts. So Yeah, they were kind of all over the place, and everyone in Nassau Bay, almost everyone, was involved in the space program. So that was just the community. It was kind of a bubble. It was probably a good thing because we really weren't that exposed to, notoriety, attention, that kind of stuff.
There's this wonderful picture in the NASA archives of you wearing your father's space helmet and just this look of pride on your father and this look of just sheer happiness on your face. You know, did you go to the Space Center with him? Like, how involved were you in his training?
I went there a few times. It's not like I was going there hanging out all the time, but, you know, probably more than a handful of times we would just kind of go hang out and, kind of walk around and do stuff. One time, I remember my brother and I got to play around in the LEM simulator. And I think they actually let me fly it, and I crashed it, which I guess
an 11-year-old probably.
Hey, you know, Neil crashed it too, I guess. So, Dad kind of made it a point every now and then to just bring us around and kind of see things and stuff like that. So that was kind of cool. But it was, like I said, it was kind of normal.
This was an extraordinarily risky mission. As a kid, were you aware of the fact that this is something that has never done before and your dad might not come back?
Kinda. I mean, I think I had tremendous faith in NASA, and there was only one thing that really bugged me, and that was the lunar ascent engine. Right, that was the one thing that I just remember being fixated on that.
As an 11-year-old?
As an 11-year-old, right. I don't know. I was a geek, I guess. Anyway, that was the one thing I was worried about, but I thought everything else was fine. It wasn't until much later in life that I realized.
As you got older, can you talk about some of those conversations you had with your dad about his experience and talking about that risk? And, you know, did he have any apprehension having a family and doing this?
You know, we never really did talk about that. We didn't talk so much about stuff in the past. I mean, I've been around when he talked about it because lots of people want to talk with him about it. But no, he's always wanted to talk about the future. And so that's where our conversations always went.
Thinking back to 50 years ago, launch day rolls around. Where were you when Apollo 11 launched?
We're in Houston. And there's kind of an interesting story behind that because for 45 years, I thought that we were in Houston because the NASA people didn't want the kids and the family, you know, at the launch complex with a bunch of cameras pointed at us in the event there was a problem, right? Nobody would want to see that. And so that was the story. And it wasn't until a bunch of us astronaut kids were getting together and we were kind of talking about this story. And one of them, I don't remember who it was, said, no, it wasn't NASA, it was our moms who insisted that we stay there and not go to the launch, which was, you know, an incredible testament to them and their, you know, their strength, their courage, looking out for the family.
Mm-hmm. You talk a little more about that. I mean, did your mom, did she protect the kids? Did you ever feel that, you know, she was overly protective or wanted to make sure that you didn't understand the risk? Obviously, you didn't know about it at the time. What was her role in this whole mission, which obviously was a crucial one?
Well, I had no idea how protective she was until 5 years ago, right? So I think my mom did a great job of kind of letting us run with it a little bit. You know, I'd go play out in the front yard with the reporters and stuff like that. So, you know, as long as we were there in Nassau Bay, I think she felt pretty protected about it. So I think I was just utterly unaware of how tense it was for her. I look at the pictures today of my mom sitting there and you know, and just, she's a nervous wreck, right? And I don't think I really noticed that as an 11-year-old.
Mm-hmm. And where were you when he landed?
In the house watching Walter Cronkite. What else would I be doing? Jules Bergman was really the guy.
Walk me through that. You know, you're watching him. What are you thinking? What are you?
So for the landing, I don't know, not that much. I mean, I was just listening, and it's kind of boring. because, you know, I wanted pictures, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have any pictures, and that was disappointing.
I just want to go back. Your dad is about to land on the moon, and you're saying it's kind of boring.
Well, I mean, I'm serious. Well, because it wasn't, you know, it certainly wasn't the first Apollo mission. I mean, there were lots of missions going on, and as particularly at that time, remember, we're launching on a very high cadence. So, I don't know, kind of part of the rhythm of life in mm-hmm. Nassau Bay at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was boring because I wanted to see pictures.
Okay.
Right? But I was not freaked about it. And when he actually walked on the moon, I was a little worried about one thing, because my dad was like hopping around on the moon, and I kind of knew that he was hopping around because he was just trying to find the best way of locomoting around the moon. And then there was some cable that was, I don't know what it was going out to, but there was a cable, and I was just convinced, you know, he was going to trip on that cable and like fall flat on his face in front of whatever, 600 million people on TV. But, you know, most importantly, you know, my 50 classmates, right, would never let me live that one down. And, I, you know, the only salvation was that they might forget because it was the middle of summer and by the time we got to school. But, I mean, seriously, that was like...
So your biggest concern is getting ripped by the kids at school.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, when it came time for ascent, then I was... I think that got much more of my attention because that was the one thing that I had kind of focused on as a risk.
Mm-hmm. That was the one engine that was responsible for getting your dad home, right?
Right. Forget about the fact that there was one engine getting them. Actually, I knew there was one engine getting them down, but if that engine failed, they just dumped the descent stage and abort. And, you know, I figured, okay, abort, no problem. They can do all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that was the one thing that worried me.
Thinking back when it did kind of fire and work and get your dad back into lunar orbit and then on his way home, was that a collective sigh of relief for both you and your family? I mean, tell me about the leaving the moon, you know?
Yeah.
That's just one step in this very risky mission.
I guess it was. I don't remember, you know, just all of a sudden breathing a sigh of relief, but I know it was a relief for me. Every one of these events, right, was a relief for the whole room. And it, at the time, you know, it wasn't just the family was in there. We had a couple of people from Life magazine, and I think, I don't know, there was always a NASA guy there, so like the NASA media relations guy, I've forgotten his name. The living room was pretty full. So, yeah, there, for every one of these events, there was kind of a cheer or something like that. But the ascent was, you know, kind of a big moment for me.
When did you get to see him when he got back?
So as soon as they got back to Houston and they were in the quarantine, I think the next morning we went to go see him. Mm-hmm. And then probably went there, I don't know if it was every day, but pretty often. And then, of course, 21 days later, he comes home.
What was life after that like? Because your father was thrust into the spotlight, even more so at that point. What was life like?
So it got kind of crazy after that because in some ways I was much more conscious of the amount of travel that he was doing. And he was doing a lot of speaking, and I don't think he was really all that comfortable with that. And then they went on the world tour, which seemed like it lasted 6 months. I think it was really only maybe a little over a month. You know, there was one day, I guess it really did hit me that this is all kind of different when we did two ticker tape parades and then the state dinner with the president. You know, so we did a ticker tape parade in New York in the morning, and then we go to Chicago and do a ticker tape parade, and then to L.A. They wouldn't let the kids dine with the president, so we just played football in the hotel room. But, yeah, so that was kind of unusual because we were flying around on Air Force Two. So, yeah, that was, I guess that was different.
You have had a storied career in engineering and now education. Is that the path that you think your dad thought that you would take in life?
You know, Dad didn't really push me in any particular direction. He didn't expect me to be an engineer. And so, I mean, actually, I went through college and I, you know, ended up being a Sovietologist at the RAND Corporation. That was my first job after I got my PhD. And so, yeah, I don't think my dad thought for a minute that that was the path that I was going to take. You know, I ended up sort of through a circuitous path getting involved in space as an executive at various companies. But, yeah, I don't think he really intended that at all.
Do you think that he thought that your generation would be walking on the moon by now?
Oh, I think he probably thought we'd be walking on Mars. I mean, he always had a vision, and his vision was, you know, always a couple of decades out in front of reality. So, yeah, I think he did.
Mm-hmm. Now, NASA is on another moonshot now, the Artemis mission, mm-hmm. targeting 2024, which means the next moonwalkers are in the NASA Corps right now and probably right. have some of their own children. What advice do you give to the next generation of moonwalking kids?
That's interesting because I hadn't thought about that. I think my advice would be, remember you're just a kid, and kid next door might be an astronaut's kid as well, and try and remember that it's not that unusual. I mean, I think for me it was a really good thing to spend at least a couple of years after the mission in kind of in the bubble of Nassau Bay. You know, the other thing I would just advise them to is not take it all too seriously.
What does your dad think about the 50th anniversary? I mean, what are his thoughts on where we are and thinking back to those missions and just the historical context of it? You know, you said he doesn't think in the past a lot, but how does he reflect on it?
The whole 50th has always been a big deal for him, but it's been a big deal for him for the entire Apollo program, not just Apollo 11. Apollo 11 just happened to be the mission that went to the moon. For him, I think it was every bit as much about the rest of the Apollo missions.
Mm-hmm. And I know, speaking with your dad about this, you know, he's always concerned that, you know, Michael Collins doesn't get the recognition that he gets or the other astronauts do as well. And I you know, that's something that I've always taken away speaking to him, is that, you know, he wanted to make sure that everyone mm-hmm. who was involved in that gets the recognition. But thinking back from your perspective, what do you want our listeners to take away from, you know, looking back at Apollo 50 years later? What do we need to be thinking about this week?
Yeah, so I think there are two things. One is that it's incredible what 400,000 people can do when they all have the same goal and they're working towards the same thing. And so that was a really incredible achievement. The other thing is, you know, we talk a lot about the technical spinoffs, and all of that stuff is great, but the real spinoff from Apollo was the people and the inspiration, right? It spun off a generation of engineers and leaders who did some really great things. But the other thing was that it spun off inspiration to, you know, literally millions of people. There are very few people that I run into that, you know, are doing incredible things today that are anywhere close to my age that don't say, you know what, it was Apollo that really inspired me. And I think that's the legacy.
Andy Aldrin, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Brandon.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by the Helios Education Foundation. Our producer this week is intern Paola Chinchilla. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, subscribe to our space exploration podcast, Are We There Yet? You'll hear more stories of Apollo 11. And we're also on the NPR One app as well. I'm Brendan Byrne, in for Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.